Hi, everyone. Welcome to Insight. I'm Charlie, and with me today is Allie. How are you, Allie?
I am doing well. I'm just happy that I discovered something new with this episode.
We've done a handful of heavy episodes recently. I think there's this perception that true crime fans have a higher tolerance for these stories, but I know in our case that's not true, not at all. And particularly our last case on William Tyrrell. Today we're going to take a bit of a breather, and we're tackling a historic mystery. And it is a bit self-indulgent on my part. Maybe one day when I have time to podcast full time, I can have an Insight spin-off history podcast. But until then, I'm just going to drop them in here and there when we need a brain break from the more recent, emotionally draining episodes. So listeners, raise your hands if you were obsessed with the musical Hamilton. I know I've thrown it at Allie recently, so what do you think of it, Allie?
I am just looking forward to it coming to Australia. I think it's 2018 and I've got like 2 years to convince my husband to come with me.
So does it translate over to non-American audience as well?
It's just like a fairy tale type story. Like, I don't really know the deep details of the political information, but it's a nice story.
Yeah, and the music is amazing.
Oh, the music's great.
So I think bringing Hamilton to you kind of makes me like an ambassador to Australia. That sounds like it should be a thing. So in short, the Tony Award-winning Hamilton is a musical about one of the founding fathers of the United States, Alexander Hamilton. The cast is primarily people of color, and the music is primarily rap and hip-hop. It's fun, and it's sad, and it's just brilliant. Some of the characters in the musical are well known to anyone in the United States who passed 7th grade social studies. Alexander Hamilton, of course, and the man who eventually killed him in a duel, Aaron Burr. So my entire family is obsessed with this musical about the $10 founding father. So when I stumbled on a mystery tangentially related to the musical, I was not throwing away my shot at covering it.
I got a very excited message saying, oh my goodness, guess what I just found?
I had to move some episode plans around because it wasn't on the schedule yet, but I wasn't going to wait for it. Okay, so I got quite a bit of lyric quoting out of my system in that paragraph, so hopefully I can rein it in for the rest. So the story we're going to talk about today is the disappearance of Theodosia Burr Alston, who was the daughter of Aaron Burr, sir. Okay, just a little extra lyric. I can't say Aaron Burr without saying sir now. It's so terrible. Theodosia isn't a major character in the play, but she has a song devoted to her called Dear Theodosia. And the song is a beautiful composition with a lullaby feel to it, with Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton singing to their newly born children after the American Revolution. So let's go ahead and give some background on Theodosia. I know that going through school, all I know about Aaron Burr is from when he became vice president, because he tied with Thomas Jefferson for president, and when he dueled with Alexander Hamilton. I know nothing else, so this was a learning experience for me too. Theodosia was the first child of Aaron Burr and his wife, also named Theodosia, and their only child together to survive to adulthood. Theodosia Sr. was actually 10 years older than Aaron Burr, and had 5 children from her first marriage. Her relationship with Burr began in secret while she was still married, and it was not a well-kept secret. And the musical gets the history right here. Her husband was a British officer. Theodosia Sr. was a revolutionary, and she hosted patriot meetings in her home while her husband was not there. After the war, her husband was still serving in the British Army and got stationed in the West Indies. She and her children did not go to him. He eventually died in the West Indies, and Theodosia and Aaron Burr married. Aaron Burr did have 2 other children with one of his servants, and I only bring this up for the trivia buffs out there. His grandson, through his illegitimate daughter, was Frank J. Webb, who was one of the very first African-American authors. So, you know, side note, because I love history. Okay, so back to the story. The younger Theodosia was really what could only be described as well-bred. She grew up in New York City, and she had a very full education that was out of reach for many young Americans at that time, particularly girls. even other girls in her station would have done like music and French, but Theodosia was given instruction in English composition, math, other foreign languages. She was taught social graces. Her mother died shortly before she turned 11, and she began acting as the hostess at the home by age 14. She was described as brilliant, independent, and these are traits that she shared with her mother. I actually spent a lot of my research just reading about these two women, and I could probably make an entire podcast just about them. So when I have my spinoff podcast, I'll do a podcast on inspiring forgotten women in history.
Theodosia had reportedly many suitors, but it was Joseph Alston, who was heir to a rice-planting fortune, that she eventually fell in love with, and she married on February 2nd, 1801, when she was 17 years old. After their wedding, they went to Washington, D.C. to watch her father be inaugurated as Vice President of the United States, and then they continued on to Georgetown, South Carolina, where Alston's family home was. Theodosia and Joseph had quite a substantial difference in their backgrounds, but by all accounts, they were very happily married. I can see why Theodosia married Joseph. I think he reminded her of her father in many ways in relation to his political ambitions and his motivation to succeed in business.
The marriage also was a good one for Theodosia because her father was having financial problems at this time, which will come up again later, and the Alston family was very well-to-do.
Yeah, I did read that the marriage might have been more about the money than romantic, but they seemed to be happy enough. And nevertheless, she did miss New York a lot in those early days, and she would write to her father quite a bit.
The climate difference between New York and South Carolina, it's just so swampy in the area she was. I can't imagine she adjusted terribly well to that.
In May 1802, after a very difficult labour, Theodosia gave birth to her son called Aaron Burr Alston, named after her father. The birth caused a serious undisclosed medical problem that was untreatable at the time, which left Theodosia infertile, and she also had recurring bouts of illness. She made frequent trips to different doctors trying to, you know, cure her illness, but nothing had lasting effects. I hadn't found a lot of specific information as to what that medical problem was, but it was so bad that in 1805 she wrote to her husband a farewell letter because she was sure she was going to die.
Yeah, let's leave Theodosia for a minute.
She needs a break. She needs to rest up.
She needs to rest up. So we're going to catch you up on what her father, Aaron Burr, was doing. Like I said, even Americans, generally, if you ask them to tell you one thing about Aaron Burr, it would be about him being the damn fool who killed Alexander Hamilton. But this duel wasn't the end of his controversies by a long shot. So the duel occurred in New Jersey, but Hamilton died in New York, and both Hamilton and Burr were residents of New York. So both states claimed jurisdiction, and both of them charged Burr with murder. So with these murder charges pending, he left and went to Georgia to kind of hide out for a bit. Neither state ended up bringing the charges to trial, so Burr returned to Washington, D.C. because he had to finish his term as vice president. And this completely blows me away. Do you have a deputy prime minister? Is that like second? Yep. So like your deputy prime minister shoots someone and then, but he's got a job to do, so he's better get back to work. I mean, it's so unbelievable that this happened this way, even in those times.
Yeah, I couldn't see it happening in this day and age.
No, certainly not. So his term ended, and so did his political career, if we're going to be honest. So he started looking westward. There are two stories to what happened next. The United States had recently bought what's called the Louisiana Purchase from France. And this like doubled the size of the United States. Future states, like where I live in Missouri, were part of this deal. According to some accounts, Aaron Burr led a conspiracy to take over some of that land in North America that may have been part of the Louisiana Purchase, but also possibly part of what Spain still owned, and start his own nation where he can be emperor.
As you do.
If this was true, it would be treason against the United States. Now, Burr's side of the story was that he was simply looking to lease a very large amount of land owned by Spain from the Spanish crown. So two very different stories. The person who kind of spearheaded pursuing the conspiracy charges was Thomas Jefferson. They were bitter rivals. In those times, even though Aaron Burr was the vice president, it's because he came in second place, not because he was chosen by Thomas Jefferson to be vice president like they do it today. So this is why that situation doesn't work out well. So Thomas Jefferson had him arrested and tried for treason. And to this day, historians still debate which story or what form of which story is actually true. And we don't know what Burr's actual intentions were, if he was going to become emperor of his own little country. However, this trial, even though he was eventually found not guilty, just about ruined him in every way. His finances, his reputation, his career. So partially in a bid to dodge his creditors, Burr fled to Europe. He spent a lot of time in England, which is kind of odd when you figure he fought in the U.S. Revolutionary War against England. Aaron Burr returned to the United States in July of 1812, and Theodosia hadn't seen her father in about 5 years and wanted to travel to see him.
During his time in exile, Theodosia, she kind of acted like his agent in the U.S. Like she raised money for him, and she transmitted messages to him. And she wrote letters trying to make it a more smooth entrance, him coming back to the U.S.
He and Theodosia were extremely close, and he wanted to return to the United States, and she made that possible for him. And he did return in July of 1812. It had been about 5 years since she had seen him, and she wanted to go travel to him. And while she was probably likely happy in her marriage, like we said, her health, the climate of South Carolina, those just did not go well together for her.
And she was so close to her father as well. It would have been hard not only being so far away from him, but not being able to get to him even if she wanted to.
Exactly. Her son died shortly before her father returned, and so between her deep mourning and her ongoing health issues, it wasn't until December of 1812 that Theodosia was able to leave South Carolina to visit her father. For those familiar with U.S. history, 1812 was the year of the conveniently named War of 1812.
How original.
And so due to the British blockades up the coast, travel by boat was difficult. But Theodosia's husband had been elected the governor of South Carolina. He couldn't make the trip with her during wartime, but he did use some connections to get a letter to the British asking that she be allowed safe passage to New York. And her father hired a doctor to take the trip with her due to her fragile health. So she's sick, she's sad, and now she's on a boat heading up the coast at a time of war. So what could possibly go wrong here, right?
And I guess that's another thing we haven't brought up, that, you know, why she was missing her father. Her husband was away a lot with his political career. So a lot of the time she was just by herself.
She was used to entertaining groups at her father's, you know, at her father's house. And now here she is isolated in South Carolina.
Yeah, she was used to being surrounded by people living a certain lifestyle, and she didn't have that anymore. I guess it's one thing when you have a small child to take all that attention away, but when she lost him, it would have been her whole world would have crashed down.
The ship that Theodosia took was called the Patriot, and Allie's going to tell us a little bit more about this boat.
Okay, so the Patriot was a schooner, which is kind of similar to, if you picture a pirate ship, you get a schooner. They were quite popular during this era because for the time they were fast and maneuverable. The ship had been commissioned by the American government during the early part of the War of 1812, but it was privately owned and no longer being used by the government. However, many schooners were used to harass the British fleet during the blockade. In order to disguise the ship's previous usage for the trip to New York, the captain hides all the guns below deck. He paints over the ship's name on the bow and completely erases any indication of the Patriot's recent activity. Theodosia, her maid, and the doctor, they board the ship in Georgetown, South Carolina, late on the afternoon of December 31st, 1812, and they head north. The Patriot was in from several months of privateering, and her hold was filled with loot from raids in the West Indies. On January 2nd, 1813, the ship was stopped by British in Cape Hatteras, which is on the coast of North Carolina. And for international listeners, according to Charlie, this is conveniently located immediately north of South Carolina. Who knew? The letter that Theodosia's husband sent must have worked, and the ship was allowed to pass. Later that night, there was a gale which scattered the British fleet. Beyond that, though, it is not known what happened to Theodosia or the Patriot. The voyage from South Carolina to New York usually took 5 or 6 days. So after 2 weeks passed and there was no sign of Theodosia or the ship, Joseph and Aaron Burr obviously became frantic. Joseph wrote to his friend, "Another mail and still no letter. I hear rumours of a gale off Cape Hatteras at the beginning of the month. The state of my mind is dreadful." In New York, Theodosia's father refused to accept that they were captured and chose to believe that she had died at sea. A friend of Burr's tried to keep his hopes up that she may be still alive, but he said, no, she's indeed dead. Were she alive, all the prisons in the world could not keep her from her father. So the Patriot disappeared without a trace.
Generally speaking, Allie and I are not particularly interested in lost ships or lost planes. You'll probably never hear another one from us. I mean, the ocean's a big place, right? Sometimes, however, the circumstances of a vanishing might give us some pause. So there are some mysteries as to what exactly happened to the Patriot and its passengers. Plus, there's the connection to Hamilton, which is really why we're doing this, let's be honest. But let's run through some of the stories going around about what happened to the Patriot and Theodosia, because Theodosia would have been a high-profile character of the time, and so instead of just being another ship that crashed, we're going to have some stories come out.
So the first theory we have is military action. There was a war going on, and while they were waved along Cape Hatteras, perhaps another vessel wasn't so kind. Or maybe they didn't get the message. Or possibly the Patriot found itself in the path of two warring ships. Or maybe it was mistaken for a war vessel and was sunk by an enemy ship. But as I said before, schooners are very fast and manoeuvrable, so an experienced captain should have been able to work around this.
Our next theory, or theories I should say, have to do with pirates, everybody's favorite topic. So these theories started popping up a lot in the 1830s as former pirates started giving their deathbed confessions. The ship was carrying passengers, but it was also carrying loot from raids in the West Indies. It was believed that the captain of the ship was planning on delivering both the passengers and the goods to New York. The pirate theory is essentially that the ship fell prey to a type of pirate called a wrecker. These pirates, instead of going out and boarding ships like you see in the movies, they would wait for a ship to wreck off the coast, and they would, instead of saving the passengers, execute them and steal the contents of the ship. They would also try to lure ships too close to the shore by using lights to imitate safely moored ships, and then attack when the ships ran aground as they came into an unsafe spot. Nag's Head, North Carolina, which is just north of the last place the Patriot was seen, they were known for having wreckers, and they were called bankers there. The evidence is essentially, like Allie said before, there was a gale, and there were pirates in the area. I mean, that's the evidence of pirates. That's all we've got. But the pirate theory actually has a few versions when it comes to poor Theodosia's fate. So the most basic one is that the wreckers dispatched with the people and stole the goods, the end. But that's kind of boring. So let's get into some more romantic notions.
And there was a book that advertised itself as a mix between fact and fiction. French pirate Dominique Yu allegedly confessed to making Theodosia walk the plank. Compiling from a few sources, it seems the captain captured the Patriot after he discovered the ship dismasted off Cape Hatteras following the storm. Yu and his pirates killed everyone but Theodosia, because no one wanted to kill such a gentle woman. after, you know, discussing it and drawing lots, it was decided that she would walk the plank.
Because that's so much nicer than killing her.
Of course. And, you know, they give a quite a romantic description of her dignity and death. I think the words they use is angelic sweetness to describe her moments before she drowned. And then there was another pirate, old Frank Burdick, and he confessed the same story. He said Theodosia was dressed in white and made walk the plank. He said that she was very calm throughout, and she simply asked the pirates to tell her husband and father what happened to her, which of course they didn't. And he also mentioned seeing a portrait of Theodosia in the main cabin, which comes up again later on.
So a third theory that's rather popular, it involves Theodosia not being killed initially. She was actually taken prisoner. Some American settlers in Texas, so we're going to go ahead and move along west. So this is along the Gulf of Mexico. They reported a Karankawa Indian chief who had a gold locket with the inscription Theodosia. He claimed he found a wrecked ship at the mouth of the San Bernard River, which is south of Galveston, Texas, and Theodosia was the only survivor on the ship.
So how far is that away from Carolina?
Pretty far. You would have to go south from North Carolina, along the coast of South Carolina, Georgia, all around the peninsula of Florida, and come back up along the coast to Texas. It's quite a distance by sea.
Okay.
So Theodosia was the only survivor on the ship, and she was chained to the bulkhead. The chief freed her and brought her to shore. She gave him the locket so he could then tell any white man he saw who she was and what had become of her. She then died, and he buried her in Texas. Now, this story floated around for a while, but its first appearance in print is in 1925. Now, I just have to say that if she was taken prisoner by pirates, why did they let her keep a gold necklace?
Exactly.
That one is a little outside what I would expect.
But a strange woman showing up seems to be the mainstay of the Theodosia myth. There is a story from Alexandra, Virginia, about a young female stranger who died in 1816 in the arms of her husband, who was also a stranger in the town. She died in Gadsby Tavern and was buried in St. Paul's Cemetery. The agreed upon fact is that she most likely died from either a mysterious illness or typhoid fever. While she was apparently unable to give a name and details about herself, her headstone reads, "To the memory of a female stranger whose mortal sufferings terminated," which is a lovely word, "on the 14th day of October 1816. And then her age is listed rather precise as 23 years and 8 months. How they knew that, I'm not sure. The man she was with left town shortly after she died. The theory is that this woman was Theodosia Burr. Some believe that she never actually got aboard the Patriot and ran away with a lover. But for that to be true, she would have had to shave a decade off her age. And since the female stranger never gave her name and was travelling in the company of a man who also gave no identifying information, I guess we don't know, but it seems highly unlikely. It's more of a fanciful idea that came out of later retellings of the story. And there's also some other fabulous theories about who the female stranger was, including that it may have been Napoleon Bonaparte in drag, but that's for another podcast at another time. Maybe your history podcast.
Yeah, my history podcast will talk about Napoleon in drag. Another mysterious stranger story came out in the late 1860s. A doctor, William Poole, was called to treat a dying woman, but there was nothing he could do for her. He helped her with her pain, and her fisherman husband was grateful for this small mercy. He didn't have any money, so instead he offered a fine oil painting of a young woman as payment. As the impoverished rarely have fine art in their homes, the doctor asked a little bit more about this painting. The fisherman then told a story of a young woman who had come ashore in a rowboat near Nag's Head, Nag's Head being north of Hatteras and pretty close to Roanoke, which we'll save for our history podcast. The woman had just the rowboat and the painting. She was struck with profound amnesia. She eventually recovered physically from her ordeal, but she never recovered her memories. She then married this fisherman and was, in fact, this woman who was dying that the doctor just treated. The doctor accepted the painting as payment, but the dying woman bolted out of bed and yelled, "It is mine, you shall not have it. I am on my way to visit my father in New York, and I am taking him this picture of his darling Theodosia." She then grabbed the painting and ran out the door and into the ocean. The woman was never seen again, but the painting drifted back to shore. So there's another version of this painting story, but it's not nearly as fantastical. Dr. Poole did take the painting in payment for treating a woman's ailments. However, she said she had gotten the painting through her husband, who found it in a wrecked ship during the War of 1812. Dr. Poole was convinced it was Theodosia Burr Alston and even had the family look at it to confirm. The biggest issue was that so few of them had ever met her. She died in her 20s, and here we are, you know, all these decades later. A sister-in-law who had known her looked at it, but she couldn't say for sure. But mind you, I mean, when I say decades, I mean like 60 years had passed in this time. So this painting is called the Nag's Head Portrait of Theodosia Burr, and it was part of a large collection that was donated to Yale University, and you can see it on display at the Lewis Walpole Library in Farmington, Connecticut. It remains unclear if the portrait is of Theodosia, though.
The one problem I have with the first portrait story is...
one problem.
If she... this is my favourite theory, but I do have a problem. If she ran off into the water with the portrait, and it's an oil painting, wouldn't it have been destroyed?
Certainly something would have happened to it. I think the painting going out into the saltwater ocean... And if it came back, why wouldn't the body of the woman have also come back? There are some problems with that story. Also, coming ashore on a rowboat with nothing but the painting and amnesia. It's just a very fanciful story. It is my favorite. And honestly, this painting is like on the top of my to-see list the next time I'm in Connecticut. You know, after I visited my grandparents and my brother and my aunts and uncles, I'm going to go see this painting.
Do we have a new entry on our world tour list?
That's right. We need to add that. So Villisca Axe Murder House and the Nag's Head Portrait of Theodosia Burr.
And one coming up for a mini episode that we can't spoil yet.
Yes, and that will definitely be on the list. So, okay, we've kind of had some fun with these theories, but we're going to make it a lame shipwreck story now.
And when Charlie gave me the outline to the script, she wrote boring underneath. And I'm thinking, what is the boring theory? It is this one.
It's this one. Logbooks from the British fleet that lined the coast report a severe storm off the Carolina coast. It began the afternoon of January 2nd, 1813, and continued into the next day. Based on calculations of smart people on the internet, the Patriot would have been right in the heart of the storm. So even if they survived the initial gales, the winds got near hurricane strength on the third. So the unromantic, probable truth is that Theodosia Burr Alston, the daughter of a vice president and wife of a governor, very likely died in a shipwreck by the morning of January 3rd. The pirate deathbed confessions could have been, I don't know, a last-ditch attempt to make history books as being linked to some romantic story of a famous woman. The painting, I mean, the painting could have washed ashore and been Theodosia. There are no records stating, she didn't write a letter to her dad saying, oh, by the way, I'm bringing a painting. There's no reports of an artist claiming having done a painting of Theodosia. And this painting wasn't, you know, discovered by the doctor for 60 years. So... I mean, really, who knows, right?
I refuse to believe that that she died in the storm. I want to believe that she ran out into the ocean with the painting and Napoleon Bonaparte in drag is the female stranger. That is what I want to believe out of this episode.
We all have our own takeaways from this episode.
That is mine.
But Theodosia growing old as a fisherman's wife sounds lovely. But... there is a little bit more to this episode, so gather around the campfire, friends. We are going to tell some ghost stories.
Ooh.
It is said that if you go to South Carolina's Lowcountry, you can see Theodosia pacing in her cloak at the port where she last said goodbye to her dear husband before boarding the Patriot.
Possibly, you can see her near her summer home at Dubordu Beach, where she was scheduled to go just 2 weeks before her son's death. She walked slowly with her head bent in sorrow.
Some report seeing her frantically seeking escape from Bald Head Island off the coast of North Carolina. In more gruesome tales, she is running from the headless ghosts of three pirates.
Or perhaps she's still roaming the rice plantation of her husband.
So, any final thoughts on the story of Theodosia Burr?
You know what I believe, and I'm sticking to it.
I think, honestly, living a life as a fisherman's wife sounds a lot better than being a ghost on the beach in sorrow perpetually for all eternity.
So she still died, but...
She still died, but as an old lady.
What are you going to do?
Yeah. I mean, she was already sick and dying, so she just sped it up a bit.
That's a good point, too, because if she was in that sick... And in that much pain, she wouldn't be wandering around as the female stranger or living a happy life as a fisherman's wife.
The shipwreck story's boring, though, so...
Yeah.
You can find all of our episodes in your favorite podcast app or on our website at insightpod.com. You can find us on Facebook at InsightPod or Twitter. You can talk to me at InsightfulPod. Allie, what's our Instagram?
At InsightPod. And you can contact us via email at insightfulpod@gmail.com.
If your podcast listening preference has a way to rate or review our podcast, we would love if you would do that. But honestly, by subscribing and downloading and listening, that all goes to support our show. If you'd like to give some little financial support, you can head over to Patreon, where anyone who donates $2 or more a month, we have our thank you minisodes up. And the one up right now is about the lost film, London After Midnight. And I just want to clarify, I know some podcasts do a per episode Patreon, and ours is per month.
Yes.
This month, where we have an extra Monday and you'll get 5 episodes this month, if your Patreon support is $2, it still stays $2. So... I hope that answers any questions people have about our Patreon.
It's $2 per month, which gives you the mini episode if that's what you choose to give. But there are other great rewards if you have a look.
We have magnets and t-shirts and all of that. So we will see you guys next time in just 1 week.
Yay, bye. Oh, then you give me the one that I can't pronounce. So do you board?
Yeah, well, you have an accent, so you can... You can just like be like, that's how we say it in Australia.
Dead body.